why does this talk matter? Well, very importantly, if we improve the group decision-making procedures that are used at the highest levels, that affects all the downstream decision-making. So in a lot of ways, it's the most effective altruistic reform we can do if we're just thinking about one institutional reform. So I have two sections here. One is on improving aggregation of individual opinions to make a group decision, and then the other is on improving the background conditions under which such decisions are made. Now, I discuss a lot of this in a lot more detail in a paper I have called A Reinterpretation of the Normative Foundation's Majority Rule. I have a link up for, you know, where you can see it in the apps of preprints. But here I'm just going to go over the very glossy, very basic details. So I think there's certain social choice results that pretty much everybody should know and be familiar with, especially effective altruists. One of them, and I think probably the most important theorem I think in all of social science, is the Gibbs-Sathaway theorem. I can't go into detail for any of these because of time constraints, but I really encourage you guys to look these up. Another is Gibbs' non-deterministic theorem, the Mueller-Sathaway theorem, Mays' theorem, and Arrow's theorem. Now, one result I am going to go over in detail is something called Condorcet's paradox. So there's a few things we have to follow with respect to Condorcet's paradox. One is we have to follow the idea of what intransitivity is. Very straightforwardly, if the group decides for A over B, and they also decide for B over C, then this should imply that they prefer A over C. And it's intransitive if it doesn't follow those basic rules. Another important concept to be familiar with is what's called independence of irrelevant alternatives. So the example I'd like to give is, like, let's say you have a group of, you know, housemates trying to choose a ice cream to purchase, right? A tub of ice cream for a house party they're having. And let's say the vendor says, oh, we have two tubs. We have one that's vanilla and one that's chocolate. And the group decides and they say, okay, we're going to go with chocolate. Now let's say the vendor says, oh, wait a second, I just realized I also have strawberry. So we would think the naturally rational thing for them to do is to choose between chocolate and strawberry. Well, they'd violate independence of relevant alternatives if now they said, oh, now our top choice is vanilla, right? So that's basically the idea. The idea is that if we're comparing two alternatives, the introduction or removal of a third separate alternative should not affect our decision on those two alternatives. Now, this is actually a very important aspect of group decision making, because if we want our group decision making function to behave in accordance with the von Neumann-Morgenstern utility function, it should have this property. So two other concepts I have to go over pretty quickly. One is called a Condorcet winner, and the other is a Condorcet method. So a Condorcet winner is an alternative that beats all other alternatives one-on-one via majority preference. And a Condorcet method is one that always guarantees the election of a Condorcet winner when one exists. So basically, what a Condorcet's paradox is it says that there exists no Condorcet method that satisfies both transitivity and independence of relevant alternatives. So this is the classic example usually given to demonstrate this. So we have three voters here and three alternatives. So the first voter, they prefer A over B over C. The second voter prefers B over C over A. And the third voter prefers C over A over B. And what you'll notice is that a majority prefers A over B, namely the first voter and the third voter. And a majority prefers B over C, namely the first voter and the second voter. Now, if majority preference were transitive, then this would imply that a majority prefers A over C. But you can actually see that the second voters and the third voters prefer C over A. So this is kind of like saying that, you know, 30 is greater than 20 is greater than 10 is greater than 30. It makes the idea of a top social preference kind of meaningless. So it's a very, very important result. Now, there's, you know, if you're interested in social choice and learning more, here's some people, you know, whose literature you might want to take a look at. I just briefly flashed them so if people on the videos can pause, they can do that. But in any case, the main goal of my discussion with respect to improving aggregation is to argue that the normative arguments for majority rule on two alternatives cannot be well generalized with majority preference, but they can be well generalized with another conception of majority rule, which is consent of the majority. So it's pretty clear why it can't be done with majority preference. This is pretty well understood in the literature. It's because it violates, you know, transitivity or IAA, right? Condorcet's paradox. But majority preference has been the standard interpretation of majority rule since roughly the 1950s. But another way of interpreting majority rule is as consent of the majority. And the way to think about this is think of each alternative as a potential contract. And if a voter is willing to consent to that particular contract, then they approve of it. But if they're not willing to consent to it, then they don't approve of it. What approval voting does is says whichever alternative is consented to or approved of by the greatest number of voters wins the election. So in other words, you're choosing the candidate that the greatest number of voters consent to. Now, we can distinguish between majority preference and consent to the majority with the following paradox. So let's say we have three friends, and two of the friends prefer pepperoni pizza over cheese pizza. And one of the friends prefers cheese pizza over pepperoni pizza. However, with respect to their what they like and what they're willing to consent, it varies, right? So with the two friends, they would consent to either pepperoni or to cheese because they like both. But the third friend, for whatever reason, they decide they only consent to cheese, right? And they could be vegetarian or something, right? Well, what we'll notice is that the majority preference is for pepperoni, but it lacks unanimous consent. On the other hand, all three would consent to cheese pizza. So what we have here is we're showing that majority preference can choose an alternative that does not have unanimous consent, even though there exists a candidate that has unanimous consent. Importantly, approval voting satisfies both transitivity and IIA, so it can overcome Condorcet's paradox. Now, it's good here at this point to look at what the history of philosophy says about majority rule. Now, I'm going to flash various philosophers' quotes up here, and you're not going to get a chance to read them, but I will mention who some of those folks are. And they're pretty standard folks. So who are some of these folks? It's like people like John Locke, Nicolas de Condorcet, John Rawls, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I'm going to focus on the Rousseau quote so you get a sense of how we're getting these interpretations, right? So what does Rousseau say? Rousseau says that when any law is proposed in the assembly of the people, the question is if it is conformable or not to the general will. Notice, he's not asking whether or not the proposal better conforms with the general will than the status quo. That would be a preference question. He's asking basically a consent question. He's asking, if it conforms, you consent. If it doesn't conform, you don't consent. So this lends itself to a majority consent interpretation as opposed to majority preference interpretation. And you can see that with the other quotes that you know were flashed by earlier. At this point, I think it's good to move on to like think, what are the main normative arguments for majority rule on two alternatives? They're primarily a procedural argument, which is May's theorem, a epistemic argument, which is Condorcet's jury theorem. It's a utilitarian argument, which is the Ray-Taylor theorem. It is a contractarian argument, and it is a statistical argument, basically the median voter theorem. Now, these arguments were collected from pretty standard work. So three of the arguments come from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Another one comes from a book by Robert Dahl, who's probably the biggest political scientist of the late 20th century, where we get four of the arguments from. Now, I'm going to discuss some of these generalizations in detail, only a few of them, actually not actually in that much detail. But if you're actually very interested in the details, you can always go to my paper, A Reinterpretation of the Normative Foundations of Majority Rule. So here's the generalization of May's theorem, right? So approval voting is the voting system with the least restricted domain, which satisfies IAA and May's theorem's four conditions: decisiveness, anonymity, neutrality, and positive responses. If you don't know what those are, don't worry about it. It's just, you know, it's something just to be there, right? The statistical argument is that approval voting maximizes a measure of central tendency. So the typical argument is something called the Black's median voter theorem for Condorcet methods. And it makes a lot of assumptions about voters and about the issue space. On the other hand, approval voting, you don't need all that. You can use a very simple set theoretic measurement, right? All you have to say is each voter is like a set. And if a voter approves of a particular alternative, then that alternative belongs to that voter set. If they don't approve of it, it doesn't belong to their set. So basically, the approval winner is the candidate that occurs at the largest intersection of sets. It's a very simple measure of central tendency that's being maximized. And so what the important aspect of all that theoretical stuff, technical stuff I just asked for, is that for all the main arguments we have for majority rule on two alternatives, we can generalize very easily to multiple alternatives with approval voting. But for majority preference, because of Condorcet's paradox, we can't do that. Now I'm going to move into some of the real-world implications of this, right? So because of the Citizens United ruling in the United States back in 2010, we basically have nomination processes that have large numbers of presidential candidates in these elections. And as a result of that, it's increasing the chances, because we use plurality voting, it increases the chances that the candidate that wins has only a small, narrow base of support, but it's a very intense one. Right, and the best example of this is with the 2016 presidential election. And a lot of people, this might be the most important slide of the day, right? So I'm going to go into detail about this this data here. Now, I should mention, I got the idea for doing this for Mohit Shetty, who actually wrote an earlier piece, which you might want to look at in the Huffington Post. But this is taken from data by surveys done by the NBC News, Wall Street Journal, back in 2015 and 2016. They were basically monthly polls, March 2015, June 2015, so forth. And during each poll, it would take, the number of candidates is the number of candidates corresponding to that poll. So when the poll was taken in March of 2015, there were 14 candidates, Republican candidates. When it was done in February of 2016, there were 6 candidates that were Republicans. Now, the population sample for these polls was drawn from Republican voters. So it's representative of the national population of Republican voters. So Democratic voters, independent voters are not involved in this, right? Now, two of the questions they ask were, mark each candidate that you're willing to support. That's basically an approval voting question. So that's this Trump support question, right? And then there's another question was, which candidate is your top preference? That's basically the Trump plurality question, right? And this basically gives the result. If you had an approval voting election of these with these Republican voters, how would Trump place in that approval voting election? And if it was a plurality voting contest, how would he place in that contest? Now, if we look at the plurality voting contest, basically from July 2015, he's basically always first place. Now, it's usually a narrow minority, like 20 to 30% of Republican voters, but he still has the plurality of votes, right? But if you look at the support, and this is Republican voters, he never is first place among Republican voters. What I find particularly interesting is that, keep in mind, in the very beginning of May 2016, Trump won the nomination because he had won enough delegates, right? So these March and April polls were basically the last ones before he won the nomination. He wins first place in both of these by plurality voting. But by basically the approval voting structure, he gets last place, 4th out of 4, and tied for last out of 3 candidates. So plurality voting and approval voting are two different generalizations of majority rule, and they lead to two very opposite outcomes. And this is why voting systems really, really matter. I can't emphasize that enough. But I think this really brings across that point. Now, one thing I want to emphasize for y'all is that it's ideologically neutral. So in 1992, most probably approval voting would have helped the Republican candidate win. But in the year 2000, approval voting probably would have helped the Democratic candidate win. Point here being is that it's not ideologically biased in any particular direction. Now, with all this, I want to make predictions which y'all can hold me accountable to, right? So because the plurality structure and everything that they use in terms of the nomination process, I'm predicting that for the 2020 Democratic nomination, no candidate will get a majority of regular delegates for the nomination, the Democratic nomination for president. So in other words, the decision will be made either by non-elected superdelegates or by a contested convention. So y'all can test me on that and see if I'm right. Now, so basically with respect to improving aggregation, there's basically 3 takeaway points I think I have, right? One is that unlike majority preference, consent of the majority maximizes our ability to satisfy the various normative arguments, but also generalizing to multiple alternatives. Another thing to keep in mind, a second point, is that approval voting is consistent with historical interpretations of majority rule. And third, approval voting can help us avoid vote splitting like we experienced in the 2016 election. So now, just take a 10-second break. You can relax. You can take a deep breath in, deep breath out. Okay, well, screw it now. We've got to keep going. All right. So now I'm going to talk about improving background conditions. Right. So if people are forced to vote in a particular way, it doesn't matter what aggregation function you use. It's going to just, you know, it's going to be whatever you're forced to do. So what that points out is that the background conditions under which voting occurs make a lot of difference. Now, I'm going to talk about a lot of this with respect to intelligence explosion hypotheses, but it's not dependent on those. It's just that they're historically intertwined in terms of the research. Much of this section is covered in two of my publications. One is the Social Choice and Value Alignment Problem in Roman Yamplaski's Artificial Intelligence Safe Security, and another one is in my article in AI Magazine, Nicolas de Condorcet and the First Intelligence Explosion Hypothesis. So Ray Kurzweil is a director of engineering at Google, and probably the most famous proponent of intelligence explosion. And among his, you know, several predictions, two of them that he's made are basically, one, that knowledge and technology growth are accelerating, and two, that human life scans can be indefinitely extended into the future. Well, that's interesting. What's also interesting is that Condorcet did it in the 1700s. What's even more interesting is that he mathematically modeled it with his jury theorem. So how does this go? Well, the simplest version of the jury theorem is like, you say you have a set of N agents, and they're confronted with a statement that's in one of two states, true or false, right? And we assume that each agent has a probability P greater than 50% of being correct, that each agent is independent in making their judgments, and that each agent is honest about, you know, their determination. The jury theorem says is that as you increase the number of agents, the probability that the majority is correct approaches one. It's basically an application of what's now the law of large numbers, which he didn't have access to. Another simpler way of putting this is that if voters are sufficiently honest, knowledgeable, independent thinking, and numerous, then a majority rule is almost always correct. So basically, what Condorcet did was he said, we want to make society into a multi-agent system that's accelerating towards correct judgment. So we need institutional change. So he was like, we need to improve honesty in society. So we shouldn't have dishonesty except when it improves honesty in the long run. And, you know, examples of institutions that promote honesty are things like contract law, right? So having that tends to improve honesty in society, right? We want to have institutional changes for knowledge. So he wanted a free press. He wanted universal free schooling. And we can think of, like, modern examples of this in terms of the work of people like Phil Tetlock with the Superforecasting, or the work of the Center for Applied Rationality. And both of them have given talks at EA, so EA is doing a lot of work related to this. He wanted changes in independent thinking, right, to promote independent thinking. So one of my favorite examples is when people voted, when masses of people voted, he didn't want them to meet in assembly. He thought they should vote by mail, because he believed if people meet in assembly, then they're going to form parties. And if they form parties, then they're going to stop thinking independently. So he wanted them to think, you know, more independently, and that's, you know, more likely if they're voting by mail, because back then long distance communication was difficult. And we can see in contemporary research, institutions that can improve independence are things like having a devil's advocate in meetings. This kind of makes sure that we don't fall into groupthink, right? And then another thing that Condorcet argued was that regardless of race, sex, or sexuality, everybody should be allowed to vote. And this is largely because it increases the number of voters you have, and this allows you to get closer to, you know, the asymptotic approach to probability of one, right? So a lot of this is discussed in Sketch. The math for it isn't discussed in Sketch, and that's what's made it so long for people to figure this out. But Sketch is probably his most famous philosophical work. And in it, he basically argues that societies that tend to fulfill the jury theorem, or at least have institutions that promote the conditions of the jury theorem, tend to be ones where knowledge and technology grow at a faster rate. So we think of places like Athenian democracy and the Roman Republic. But then societies that don't have those properties, like, you know, late antiquity European societies, they tended to have reversed or slowed growth in knowledge and technology. But what he argues that in the long run, because of various, you know, technological changes like the printing press and things of that nature, that he thought that human knowledge and technology were growing at an increasing rate over time. Now, there are several people who have generalized the jury theorem, and I've given you a set of these people, and they have very excellent papers, which I encourage you guys to look at if you get a chance. But I think we should look at this less as just trying to generalize the jury theorem and look at this more systematically as multi-agent systems. And that's actually what Condorcet did. Like, he actually developed several theorems in terms of information aggregation. Like, he even showed theorems where, like, if you have this set of background conditions, you probably want to use a minority rule instead of majority rule. And an example of where, you know, the multi-agent framework is helpful, I think, is an example, a preschool example, right? So let's say you have a class of preschoolers, say 3-year-olds, right? And then you also have an adult teacher, right? And we'll assume that the teacher is knowledgeable about crossing roads, and the students aren't knowledgeable about crossing roads, or at least not very knowledgeable. And the goal is they want to figure out when to cross the road, right? And we'll additionally assume that among the kids, the 3-year-olds, there's a 4-year-old that's a bully of all the other kids, right? And that this bully is like, whatever the opinion of this bully is the opinion adopted by all the other students. Well, so one question we can have is, given these background conditions, what is the best way to aggregate information? And we can pretty clearly say that, like, majority rule is not going to work. And the specific reasons we can say this is because there's low information and the opinions are highly dependent on the opinions of the bully. So majority rule is going to be pretty bad in that situation. In fact, we probably say you want a dictator, that dictator being the teacher, who's the adult, and the people being lorded over are the 3-year-olds, right? The second question asks is, well, if we want the group to use a particular decision-making method, how should we change the background conditions to make the method effective? So say our goal is to make sure that each of the students can individually decide when to cross the road. Well, we want institutions that decrease the dependence of the students on the bully's opinion, right? And we also want to increase the students' knowledge of crossing the road. Now, this might take a few years, but these are the institutions you want in place so that they will start making this judgment independently of each other. So maybe when they're like, after 5 years, when they're 8, they can figure out, oh, this is when I cross the road. This is not when I cross the road, right? But so the multi-agent model gives it an idea to actually formalize this whole idea, right? Now, there's two basic questions that this multi-agent modeling can actually be very appropriate for. One is, how should we aggregate information when confronted with a particular set of background conditions? And two, how should we change background conditions if we want to use particular information aggregation methods? Now, you might say, well, the multi-agent framework, it's overkill when you're dealing with this kindergarten class or when you're dealing with the classic jury theorem conditions. But that's because they're corner cases for simple illustration. When you deal with real complex real-world situations, you're going to have a lot of interweaving interdependencies in judgments. You're going to have a lot of varying levels of knowledge, and it's going to get very complex very quickly, basically a combinatorial explosion, and you're going to have to use approximation algorithms. Now, here I lay out a model, a very oversimplified model for, like, you know, what you might do with that. But the main point here is that, unfortunately, the vast majority of cases are going to need, approximation algorithms to solve them. And this is the thing that kind of saddens me, is that even though it's pretty obvious that, you know, you're going to need algorithmic game theory to kind of approximate solutions for this, to my knowledge, there are no applications of algorithmic game theory to any of these multi-agent system type problems. I mean, there are to other kinds of problems that require epistemic aggregation of information, but not these kinds that deal with, you know, people with the dependencies and the knowledge probabilities and things of that nature. And I think there's this a big place where there needs a lot of research. And to give you an idea of how important this multi-systems research is, so there was a course taught in the fall of 2018 called Safety and Control for Artificial General Intelligence. And 25 of the 28 sessions for that class, that's 93% of them, were focused on two-agent or multi-agent systems. So, and this class is taught by Andrew Critch and Stuart Russell. I think multi-agent systems are very, very important for AGI control, not only, improving human decision-making. Now, there are several problems that these multi-agent systems could be used to address. One is the expert independence problem, right? So, like, presumably, if we become overly reliant on experts, like, say, for example, like, only Democrats only listen to whatever you know, some MSNBC commentator says, and all Democrats only do whatever some Fox News commentator says, then our judgments are going to collapse and it's not going to get as good judgment. And so the question is, what are the appropriate background conditions and appropriate aggregation methods for relying on experts? Another question is deliberation and groupthink. So there's a lot of empirical evidence that shows that deliberation improves group decision making. But we can also see the case where if people start interacting with each other, you could form a mob mentality. So the question becomes, well, under what conditions does a mob develop when you have such communication? What situations do you get deliberation that actually improves judgment? So the question that multi-agent modeling can figure out is, what are those background conditions and how should we aggregate the information so that we avoid the mob mentality, but we get good sharing of information that helps us make better judgments? A third question, and this comes from John Dryzik, is the issue of deliberation and intermittent polling, right? So presumably it might be of interest to poll people during the process of deliberation, just to get a sense of how things are changing and, you know, how we can improve things. But presumably that can also cause people's opinions to solidify if we're polling them about their opinions and make further deliberation useless. So the question arises, okay, well, under what background conditions is intermittent polling useful and under which conditions is it not useful for deliberation? I think there can be a lot of synergies between deliberative democracy research and multi-agent systems research. You know, multi-agent research could suggest empirical tests of deliberative practices, but, you know, the empirical deliberative democracy research could suggest multi-agent modelers phenomena that they could try to model and explain. So if you want a primer in deliberative democracy, there was a recent article in Science called The Crisis of Democracy and the Science of Deliberation. And here's a list of a few experts, you know, Josh Cohen, John Dryzik, Fishkin, you know, Landa Moore, several others. And you can look at their work, and that can be a start if you're interested in learning about deliberative democracy. So overall, I think there are five major takeaways here. First is that I think there are several social choice results that pretty much every effective algorithm should be aware of. Second, and this is heuristically speaking, approval voting is probably the best norm for aggregating information in a democratic fashion. Third, there are many meaningful interpretations of the majority rule, not just majority preference, and actually just not also consent of the majority. Fourth, heuristically speaking, improving democratic group decision-making, it should entail, roughly speaking, honesty, knowledge, independence, and universal suffrage. So you want to generally promote those properties or those characteristics in your people who are participating in your group judgments. And third, fifth, is that group decision making can become very complex very quickly, and it's very useful and it's very urgent to have multi-agent research in this field to better understand these things. So before we switch, just a few couple things. We're having a voting methods meetup right outside of this room at the end of the session. I have office hours tomorrow from 12:30 to 1 p.m. in the Queen Vault. And finally, and the most importantly, I love each and every one of you, and I look forward to learning from all of y'all. Y'all have a good day.